Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, live from the WNYC studios in Soho. Thanks for sharing part of your day with us today. On the show tomorrow, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Susan Laurie Parks. She's adapted the classic Jamaican film The Harder They Come into a reggae musical, and it opens at the Public Theater. She'll join us to discuss. And for more great conversations with creators, all this week at 9 p.m., listen to WNYC for a special broadcast of the program Helga. Tonight, host Helga Davis speaks with visual artists Kara Walker and Glenn Ligon. Tune in tonight at 9 on 93.9 FM, or you can always live stream that at WNYC.org. That is in the future, but right now, let's get this hour started with Shirley Chisholm. Full Bio is our monthly series when we have a continuing conversation about a deeply researched biography to get a full understanding of the subject. It is Women's History Month, so we chose a book about a glass ceiling breaker, New York's own Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman to be elected to Congress, the first black candidate to seek a major party's nomination for President of the United States, and the first woman to run for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Here she is from that historic day in 1972 when she announced her candidacy.
I stand before you today as a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States of America. I am not the candidate of Black America, although I am black and proud. I am not the candidate of the women's movement of this country, although I am a woman, and I'm equally proud of that. I am not the candidate of any political bosses or fat cats or special interests. I stand here now without endorsement from many big-name politicians or celebrities or any other kind of prop. I do not intend to offer to you the tired and glib cliches which for too long have been accepted part of our political life. I am the candidate of the people of America.
The book we are discussing this week is titled Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics by University of Kentucky professor Anastasia Curwood. While the book does offer details about Chisholm's life, it's also an examination of what she wanted to accomplish and how she steadily accrued power and how she was engaging in intersectionality long before it had a name. We begin today's conversation with some information about her family's background that informed her political career. She was the oldest of four girls. During the Great Depression, Shirley was sent to Barbados to live with her grandmother for a time and went to school there, learning to read and write at a very young age. Her grandmother, Emmeline Chase, was her hero and instilled in her great confidence that at times would cause friction with Shirley's mother, Ruby, once her daughter returned to New York City. We start today's Full Bio in Brooklyn with author Anastasia Curwood. Shirley Anita St. Hill was born in Brownsville, Brooklyn, November 20th, 1924. Her family was from Barbados. What was happening in Barbados in her parents' generation that Bajan people were leaving for the States?
What's happening in Barbados is economic stagnation for the majority of the working class and poor black people living in Barbados. Remember that Barbados, just like the United States, was a was founded with by England. It was a colony of England and also imported chattel slavery, African chattel slavery. And so her family was a descendant of the enslaved people who had lived on Barbados. And although emancipation had come a little sooner in Barbados, and it there was not the Jim Crow system that was in Barbados, still economics were pretty tough. And so her parents decided to try to make their fortune in the United States.
What is something about Shirley Chisholm that lets you know she was from Barbadian roots?
Well, I would say it was her sense of of capability, that she could do things the best that anybody could do. She was a very proud person, and she just had this unfailing belief in her own abilities. So I think that confidence and almost sort of swagger, or some people might say egotistical, but I don't know that it was something like that. I think it was just that was kind of her who she was, and just that she really did believe in herself.
What was an event in each of her parents' lives that really shaped the way that Shirley was raised?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, for both of them, it was the trip to the United States. But let me give you one thing from her father's family that was a little bit different. That he was born in Guyana, but he was Barbadian. He was descended from Barbadian folks. He was baptized in Barbados, and then he was orphaned at a fairly young age and raised by his grandparents. And he sort of was a very independent person very early in his life. He also, you know, eventually he became involved in labor politics and with Marcus Garvey, and so he was a mentor to his daughter. And his name was Charles St. Hill. Ruby Seal was raised by her mother, who was a single mother in Barbados. And her father had gone to work in the Panama Canal Zone and brought back a good bit of money. And her parents divorced because her father gave away so much of that money that he really frustrated his wife by giving money away to people, but not supporting the family in the way that she thought that they should be supported. So I would say both of those experiences, mm-hmm. in addition to that migration to the United States, was important to Charles and Ruby, and would have left their mark on the family as well.
My guest is Anastasia Curwood. She's the author of Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics. It is our full bio this month. The family settled in Brooklyn. Why Brooklyn? Why did the St. Hill family wind up there? And how did they make ends meet?
Yeah. So the family settled in Brooklyn because that was where most of the Caribbean people went when they came to New York. And, you know, as you and your listeners all know, New York is a city of cities. It's mm-hmm. it's full of neighborhoods. And so a lot of Black people who had been born in the United States went to both Brooklyn, especially Bed-Stuy, and to Harlem. But the Caribbean people tended to concentrate in Brooklyn, and especially Bed-Stuy, Brownsville, where Chisholm, the future Shirley Chisholm, then Shirley St. Hill, was born. You can read the wonderful novel, classic novel by Polly Marshall, Brown Girl, Brown Stones, about a Barbadian family or Bajan family in Brooklyn. This was right where that family lived would have been right around where Shirley Chisholm's family lived. Mm. And so as it happened, they each Charles met an uncle, supposedly, although I don't know that he really was an uncle. I think he might have just told the immigration officials that he was an uncle in Brooklyn. And at that point, Ruby Seal, Shirley's mother, had a sister who was living in Brooklyn. And so they both wound up there. But what's important is to know is that they actually grew up in the same neighborhood. Their families knew each other. They knew each other. So they already knew each other. It was just the community was sort of gathering in Brooklyn, and it had a snowball effect that a few people went and then a few more. So that was why they wound up there.
Shirley's mom, Ruby, had precise rules, and Shirley was described as, quote, not an easy child. Where did they clash, and what form did not being an easy child take?
Well, I guess it started when Shirley was 3 or so years old, and her little sister, Muriel, was just a baby, and Ruby came in to find Shirley with the baby on the toilet, commanding her to learn to use the toilet as almost an infant. And I guess she loved to use the pull chain on the toilet. And so she just was trying to get everybody to use it. But she said, my mother just could not control me. And she said, my mother had all these antiquated ideas about how long could her children go to a party? And she said, we were supposed to go to the party and be rigidly on time, and then stay just 1 hour and leave immediately after 1 hour. She said it was embarrassing, and so she would push back. But I think her biggest point of rebellion was her mouth, that she would just sort of say anything. And if she did not agree, if she thought she should be doing it a different way, she would say so. So she said, my mother just couldn't control me.
The three women that Shirley Chisholm said were her role models were Eleanor Roosevelt, Mary McLeod Bethune, and her maternal grandmother, Emmeline?
I've been saying Emmeline, but I'm not quite sure.
Emmeline Chase Steele, we'll go with that. What did she take away from her grandmother that really helped Shirley Chisholm succeed?
Yeah, she had a very strong relationship with her grandmother, a little bit of closeness that she might not have had with her mother. And what she said was that it was her confidence. It was her fearlessness. That her grandmother was somebody who worked for white people. She was a cook. She was a well-respected and talented cook. But young Shirley recalled that, you know, if the white people were sitting at the table late into the evening, her grandmother couldn't come home. That, you know, they'd be sitting there drinking and carousing, and Emmeline Steele couldn't get home to her family until they all went home. So it was a servant's position, but that Shirley remembered that her grandmother had just tremendous dignity and self-confidence, and carried herself in a way that claimed her personhood, even though she wasn't always treated like a full person by her employers. So she got that self-confidence. And it seemed like her grandmother encouraged that outspokenness while most of the rest of the family, except maybe her father, discouraged it. So they had that in common. And she said it really made a big impression on her as a very young girl to speak her mind.
What was it about Eleanor Roosevelt and Mary McLeod Bethune that Shirley Chisholm admired?
Well, both of those women were professional women. Remember, this is a time when professional women in public were quite rare. Mm-hmm. These are also women who are active in the highest levels of the government. So Eleanor Roosevelt, as First Lady, took her office very seriously, advanced the careers of women journalists, advocated for policy. Mary McLeod Bethune was in the executive branch, had conversations with both Eleanor Roosevelt and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, advised them, was National Youth Secretary during the New Deal. And so both of them were sort of at these high levels. But the other thing was that they're both interested in reform and in enlarging the democratic project. So bringing women and Black people fully into economic and political citizenship. And that was Shirley Chisholm's bedrock idea as well.
My guest is Anastasia Kerwood. She's the author of Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics. It's our choice for full bio. Shirley was offered scholarships at Vassar and Oberlin. She went to Brooklyn College for economic reasons. Where did she flourish in college, and where did she flounder?
Well, according to her, she didn't flounder at all.
Right.
Although I would say that, she was very self-confident. I would say that she struggled or was less active socially, and that the boys especially saw her as sort of boring because she would study. She liked to study. She said she was there to study. And so she didn't have as active a social life. And when she did go out to parties, she did love to dance. And she said they'd be surprised at what a good dancer she was. As far as thriving, she did well, well enough in her classes. What she really liked was political science. And she had a political science professor who she took pains to point out was blind. And so, you know, that maybe he didn't, he was not as swayed by racism, at least from people's phenotype. I'm not sure if that was the case, but he really encouraged her. And he said, you really should think about going into politics. She excelled in the debate club and in her courses with him. And she said, oh, no, I can't do that. I'm a Black woman. I can't. Or she probably would have said, I'm a Negro woman or I'm a colored woman in the terminology of the time. And she said, I can't do that. I've got to get something practical. So I'll get a sociology degree and a Spanish minor, because there are a lot of Puerto Rican people in Brooklyn, and I'll go into teaching, which is a pretty safe and a ticket into the middle class for Black women then and now. And so she decided, I'm going to go with sort of the road that's more traveled. And that's what she did, at least for temporarily.
We'll continue our full bio conversation about Shirley Chisholm after the break, with her first career in education and her first experience with heartbreak. That's next. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Full Bio is our monthly series when we have a continuing conversation about a deeply researched biography to get a full understanding of the subject. Let's get back into our interview with Anastasia Curwood about her book, Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics. After Brooklyn College, Chisholm began a career as an educator in New York, working at the Mount Calvary Child Care Center in Sugar Hill, Harlem. Shortly after landing the job, she enrolled at Columbia University's Early Childhood Education Program and got her master's by 1951. It was during this time that Chisholm met with a significant personal obstacle. She'd fallen in love and become engaged to a dishonest man. Shirley Chisholm's first job was as an educator, a teacher, but it really grew into more. Tell us a little bit, Anastasia, about her first job and then where it led to.
So her first job was in early childhood education. And she says it took her a long time to get hired because she was small, she was tiny. She looked very young, and it was difficult for her to get a job, but she did finally persuade her boss, her future boss at a child care center in Harlem, to hire her. And early childhood education was her passion. And so she stayed there for several years, but eventually she was recruited away to be to lead a child care center back in Brooklyn that was privately run. And she ran that for a few years. Eventually she was hired by the Hamilton Madison Child Care Center in Lower Manhattan. And eventually she moved into administration and consulting for the school district for the city of New York. So in the space of a dozen years, she rose fairly high in terms of being of leadership in early childhood education in the city.
Before we talk more about her career, I did want to get a little bit of her personal life in here so people can understand that she just wasn't this efficiency robot her entire career. You know, and this one story you tell in the book, which I thought was really heartbreaking, was for all her sort of strength, she had moments when her emotions did get the better of her. She had a breakdown earlier in her life when she discovered that her fiancé at the time had been lying to her, that he maybe even had another a wife.
Whom she met.
What happened that shook her so in this relationship?
Well, I think this was her first serious relationship. You know, she says that, oh, well, I danced with some of the boys sometimes at the dances. And she defied her mother by, you know, letting boys walk her home and kiss her on the front stoop. But this, she really fell in love as a senior in college. And she fell in love with a man who, it turned out, he didn't just have a wife, that he actually was part of a criminal enterprise smuggling people into the United States from Jamaica. And I was able to find a big immigration ring case that was prosecuted around the time in 1949 that the future Shirley Chisholm, her fiance, I guess he was involved in. There was a big human smuggling ring, and so he was getting in trouble with the law, and he also managed to get the woman who seemed to be his wife to arrive from Jamaica. But she was introduced to Shirley as his friend, who he was helping out. And then this woman was very hostile to Shirley, who started to wonder what was going on. And eventually she did figure it out. She found out that he'd been arrested. She visited him at Ellis Island just before he got deported. And he really had nothing to say to her. And it really broke her heart. So what she says is that she had a breakdown, that she went to a farm in the country. I don't know where that was. I haven't been able to discern where that was. She did keep her job at the first job that she had, but she said she really just lost it for a while. And it's a rare moment of self-disclosure that she gives, but it was formative to her, because the rebound guy who she met not long after this occurred was a man named Conrad Chisholm. And he was so stable, a really genial, caretaking, he's a good cook, just a really solid person, was sort of the antidote to this fly-by-night person that she'd met, who had really broken her heart. And so she stayed with Conrad Chisholm for the better part of, or for over 20 years. I don't want to skip ahead and spoil things too much.
No, it's okay. We can say that as I wrote on my notes here, he was the right husband at the right time until he wasn't.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, that you know, he really took care of her, and she needed that at that point in her life, but she was again swept off her feet later, I'll just put it that way, and she that marriage did end, and she married somebody else.
Her second husband did come much later in her life when she was already in Congress. And something I thought was interesting that you wrote about was some of her political enemies tried to make hay of the divorce and of the relationship. Mm-hmm. How did her needs in a spouse change over the course of her career? And why would her divorce be something that could be used against her at that point in her career?
Well, we'll start with the second, which was the second part of the question. She's still a Black woman in politics. She's still suspect. She's only conditionally tolerated. Black women have historically been subject to stereotypes about promiscuity and loose morals. And she really wanted to protect her image. So it could have been used against her to say that, well, her morals are suspect. Now, most people at that point, her career was pretty well established. At that point, she'd been serving in the Congress for 8 years. She had made some good allies in the Congress. She had a track record. So she was a little bit less vulnerable than she otherwise might have been. But still, she had a sort of nemesis who reported on the divorce in a somewhat salacious manner. And, the first part of what you asked is why then would she remarry? And her second husband was someone she actually met very early in her political career in the state house, in the New York State Assembly. And she met him. She said she immediately thought he was handsome. They bantered, but they were both married. And in later on, so 10 years, 12 years later, his wife passed away. And he was suddenly single. And at that point, as I said, she was well established. Mm-hmm. She had a career. She's not trying to run for president anymore. And so I think she was able and willing to take that risk and become a divorcee and marry the person I think really was the love of her life. She really did seem to fall for her second husband,
whose name was Arthur Hardwick, by the way. And they were together mm-hmm. until his death. My guest is Anastasia Curwood. The name of the book is Shirley Chisholm, Champion of Black Feminist Power Politics. It's our choice for full bio. Let's get back into Shirley's career. How did Shirley Chisholm make the leap from educator to politics? What was the first step?
Well, what I understand to be the first step was her involvement in tenants' rights organizations. And unfortunately, there is not a strong archival base for this. This just came from some interviews and some a little bit of mapping that I was able to do. That she was involved with the Albany projects in Brooklyn, in New York public housing. But that was sort of how she got involved. And my guess is she got involved through parents and working with parents of the children whom she was teaching. What she says and what happened are actually two different things. What she says is that she met her political mentor through her hairdresser just out of college. I'm not sure that it happened exactly that way, but eventually she did meet this mentor who was running in 1953, so about 6 years after she left college, was running a campaign to elect a black judge in Brooklyn. And this came about because a midterm appointment was made, and there was the opportunity to appoint a very well-respected lawyer who was black as a judge, and he was passed over. And so a movement arose to get him elected to a proper term as a judge. And this evolved into something called the Bedford-Stuyvesant Political League. And her mentor was a man named Wesley Holder. Everybody called him Mac Holder. That he was the leader of Bedford-Stuyvesant Political League. And she was involved with this group for years, for the better part of a decade, for about six, seven years. She also started attending meetings of the regular Democratic Club. And what I mean by that is that New York, mid-century, had Democratic clubs in every one of the state assembly districts. So in that state assembly district, there was an assembly man or woman elected. Most of them were men in Chisholm's time. And there was also a district leader who sort of managed the processes of getting people elected and also all the patronage that New York politics are famous for. Mm-hmm. And well, if you work hard to get me elected, then you can get a job as the sanitation official in Borough Hall or in other places in government. So there's a strong patronage network. And Chisholm started going to the meetings of the regular Democratic, the establishment mm-hmm. Democratic Club. But we talked about this earlier. Earlier in our conversation, we said that Brooklyn was a haven for migrants from the Caribbean, but also a lot of Jewish people were in Brooklyn. Puerto Rican people were in Brooklyn. So there's a sort of Irish and Italian monopoly on political power and running these political organizations. And there starts to be an insurgent movement. And so she was coming of age, political age mm-hmm. at the time when some of these old established patterns were getting disrupted. And that was when she really got going in politics, because eventually she got involved in the Unity Democratic Club, which sought to unseat the existing district Democratic Club. And that's what launched her career in electoral politics.
The mentor you mentioned, Mac Holder, his, I believe, New York Times obituary headline called him the Dean of Black Brooklyn Politics.
Yeah.
He would be a great mentor to have, but she made a decision that sort of set a template for how she might move through her professional career. She decided to go for a position in the Bedford-Stuyvesant Political Club. You write about this, which angered Holder.
Well, sure. Yeah, she tried to take his job. She tried to take over. She was nothing if not ambitious. Shirley Chisholm was incredibly ambitious. And she was, she really cared about the issues, in particular expanding democracy, small d democracy. But she was also really ambitious, and she was pretty sure she could do it the best.
On tomorrow's Full Bio Conversation, we'll hear about Chisholm's official entrance into electoral politics, her legislative priorities, and how she arrived at her congressional campaign slogan, Unbought and Unbossed. That's tomorrow.